Hi. It remains to be seen whether you're going to enjoy this, but I think I will. There's an article by Mark Blyth in The Guardian. Now, Blyth is one of the economic advisors to the SNP, Nicola Sturgeon, and he's less than helpful in some of his comments. Some of the things he said recently about the impact of Scotland leaving the United Kingdom and the scale of that compared to, for example, the United Kingdom leaving the European Union. Were less than helpful. I think probably they'd have sacked him at that point if that would only if that wouldn't have just increased the scale of the disaster and made more people look at what he was saying. So I think the SNP had to ride it out, but it was a bad few days when the Tory party and others made hay with the comments. So Mark Blyth is an advisor to the SNP, and he's got an article, and he's more broadly a man of the left. He's part of a group of academics who are commenting on things like monetary policy and industrial policy and the nature of global capitalism and the taxation of international corporations and so on. So he's got a finger in a lot of pies, but the thing that unites all these areas of interest is this broadly sort of left-leaning progressive critique of the present state of affairs. What we've seen from 2000 in terms of the growth in international trade, the loss of previously highly paid jobs in the developed world, and these corporations that appear not to have any rooted identity. He mentions Apple, which we'll come to in a second. Apple's an odd organisation because most of what Apple actually does in terms of manufacture isn't in the US. The US is essentially an administrative and a labelling and an intellectual property hub for the company. So Blyth is a commentator on a whole load of issues, but the thing that unites them is a critique of the last 20 years or 25 years. And as I say, he's using a visit to some friends in New York to make comment on the situation in the US concerning middle class jobs and the purchase of property. Two of his pals, I think, bought a property in Brooklyn for $1.5 million in what was otherwise a pretty rundown area. With as he says in his article, one that was stubbornly resisted gentrification. In other words, a pretty rough place. So people in their mid-40s with good jobs, upper middle class jobs, are buying houses in their mid-40s. I didn't buy a flat until I was 55, never mind 45. I could have done earlier had I not been so risk averse. But generally across the world, people are buying properties later, and this is despite the fact that interest rates are ridiculously low. So you would think that people would be incentivized to buy, but in actual fact, not only are the people cautious, but the banks are cautious as well. The banks want deposits because they think that another downward lurch in property prices would leave them underwater on the mortgages. So he's visiting his friends and he spots a group in the park nearby, and these are sort of you can almost people don't like to generalize, but you can usually tell from the way people dress, the way their hair is cut. Their skin tone in a million and one ways were very good at placing people, and he thinks that he was looking at, and indeed he was looking at, a group of glossy middle class preppy Ivy League types. And what was odd was they were having a tenants union meeting to try and resist sales of property and rent rises in their area. And what was happening was developers were buying single family homes. The Americans have this expression, a single family home, and what they mean is a house sitting in a little plot. And developers were buying these properties and flattening them and building apartments. And this was contributing to a general rise in rents that was serving to make life very difficult for these aspiring architects, IT workers, and other professionals with their university degrees, but less in the way of moolah than you would think. One of the big, I always quote this because it stuck with me. Andrew Sullivan is a really good writer. He used to be a Brit, now he's an American. Andrew Sullivan was going home from finishing off the copy, finishing the final version of his magazine that he was editing. And he was heading back on the elevated train looking at all these homes with barbecues at the back. A neighbourhood that was almost entirely full of cops and firefighters because they tend to huddle. So there's this neighborhood, and in every back garden you could see somebody turning the burgers on the barbecue and drinking beer with all his pals, having a good time. And the thought occurred to him that these public sector workers, these firefighters and cops, were making more money than the staff in the magazine, despite the fact that they were all named people. You know, you would know they had a profile, but in actual fact they were making no money. So these glossy middle-class kids are trying to make their way in the world living in Brooklyn, are forming unions to try and resist the purchases of property by developers and ever-rising rents. So the prosperous, never mind the working class, the blue-collar workers who used to form unions, it's the prosperous middle-class kids are forming unions. And their problems are exacerbated by what Bligh thinks has happened since the 2007-08 housing crash. People talk about securitization, and they're often not sure what they mean by that. In the case of housing, what it meant was that the banks who would otherwise be left holding the baby when they make a mortgage loan, the way it works is banks lend money into existence. People don't understand the money system. You don't have to have deposits in order to make loans. The famous episode in It's a Wonderful Life when the people want to take the money out of the savings and loans, and lampooned fantastically, as I've said before, by The Simpsons, when the manager explains that he can't give Carl his money back because it's in Lenny's house. And Carl, I think, says, "Hey, Lenny, why is my money in your house?" and punches him in the face. In a savings and loans, it might be the case that you can only make loans when you've got deposits. The old rule used to be 363. Pay 3% on the savings, charge 6% on the mortgages, and be on the golf course by 3 o'clock. Savings and loans are a very different thing. Banks don't need deposits to make loans. They lend money into existence. And if the loans go bad, then the bank's fundamental capital is in jeopardy. So that's why banks don't make bad loans, because when the loans go bad, then they lose their investors' money, the equity, the shareholders' money. So banks lend money into existence. That causes a problem, because your balance sheet then can only be a certain size. It can be very large. You can end up in a situation where you've got £33 loaned out to every £1 of fundamental capital, which becomes a problem when the prices of the property start to fall. But you can make a lot of lending. Now, you can make even more lending if you just become a broker effectively for dentists in the Midwest who want to invest for a steady return, because that's what a bank becomes when you start getting the mortgages off your books and selling them as bonds to investors. Northern Rock claimed that they were securitizing. They claimed that they were getting the mortgages off their books and therefore the investors in the bank weren't at risk. It turned out that was complete rubbish, as I remember it. There was a wholly owned subsidiary in Guernsey which they were using to effectively store the mortgages. They weren't properly securitized at all. But securitization involves creating bonds. So instead of you having a $200,000 mortgage sitting on your balance sheet as an asset and, you know, $12,000 a year coming in as interest payments, with the danger that the loan goes bad and your shareholders lose money, what you do is you sell that $200,000 mortgage to a load of investors, typically high earners like dentists who want low returns but stable returns. And that's what securitization is. You bundle up the mortgages. Now, what happened in the financial crisis was that people realised that these supposedly safe assets with a steady income stream weren't safe at all. And it was better to actually own the property, because that way you've taken the banks and the agents out of the loop, and you can have your own people looking at the property and buying it. And what happened during the crash was that it was possible for these investors to buy in scale. So because there was a lot, it was very difficult to buy enough property to make it worthwhile, because you've got lots of fixed costs. So what you need are lots of properties available at one moment in time, and that was what the financial crisis created. So the investors did that and thereby created scarcity, and that's why you've now got these middle-class tenants action groups trying to avoid the higher rents and the loss of these properties that they rely on for the development in apartments they could probably not afford. So this thinks Blythe is just one of the things that's happening to these middle-class kids. It's one part of a broader nightmare, which includes, for example, the so-called good jobs going. The classic graduate job, which Jordan Peterson fantastically describes as the man in the 60s when, you know, the hippie generation were leaving university. The man trying to colonise you by giving you a high-paid job and allowing you to have a really comfortable life. You know, wasn't that awful? You know, a pension and complete security and the chance to retire in your 50s. And steady work, you know, wasn't it awful when we were all being colonized and tyrannized by the man, capitalism? So these good jobs, people would love now to be exploited. Please create an Exxon or a JCPenney or some other company that's going to give me some boring middle class job that pays me $100,000 a year. People complained about these jobs, and now that they're gone, they're complaining that they're gone. So the wage premium, in other words, the extra amount of money that you would expect to make over and above what you would make if you were a non-graduate, that is evaporating. Graduates aren't making the kind of extra money they used to make. And the only growth that's taking place, thinks Blythe, is in the megacities of New York, Los Angeles, London, or Londinium, as some people call it, the city-state of London. And people are drawn into these places as a hub for the kind of businesses that they want or need to work in, and that drives up rents. So the after rent disposable income for these graduates who are drawn into these megacities is very low, and you end up with people who've got an apparently highly paid job, but in actual fact their disposable income is incredibly low. One of the problems we've got in Scotland is that we're handing over much above market wages to public sector workers in low cost parts of the country. And it's something that nobody can address because it's too painful in the short run in terms of loss of votes. So all these mainly private sector kids working in these few expanding industries are being drawn into the mega cities, and they're after rent and after tax income and after student loan payment income is very low. Now, Blythe has got a very odd idea. I'll come to it in a minute about why Mark Blythe is a bit like me. And in fact, he's less like me than I am like Paul Krugman, the economist. But Blythe thinks that high profits in companies actually make it possible for them to pay high wages. And in a minute, I'm going to suggest that's a very odd view of how economics works. He's right, though, about one thing. Which is that these knowledge economy companies employ remarkably few people, and there's remarkably few of these really big knowledge economy companies. Google, becoming a Google engineer and becoming one of the kids with a hoodie on during the working day who gets to play table tennis whenever they like, supposedly, I suspect it's a bit more arduous than that. But becoming one of these people is make or break for a lot of young kids. One of the famous Google questions that I liked was, why are manhole covers round? And the answer is because of the shape. It means that the cover can't fall down the hole. I think it was Feynman was asked that question. The physicist, now dead physicist, and Feynman said they aren't, which is an even better answer. You know, the a lot of manhole covers aren't round. But the make or break applications that young people with their IT and maths degrees make to these few companies, if they don't get into Facebook or Google or possibly a startup that offers lots of share options and the startup then becomes successful, then they're in big trouble. And the companies defend their position. Facebook buys its competitors. Apple sues Samsung for stupid things like, for example, rounded corners on phones. I'm using a phone right now, a Motorola phone. Strongly recommend it, actually. I'm using a phone with rounded corners. Apple tried to pretend that rounded corners were an invention, and therefore the other companies shouldn't be allowed to use rounded corners. So what they're trying to do is create what Blythe describes accurately as legal and technical barriers. They're trying to reduce competition and thereby raise prices by making it difficult for people to compete with them. And he thinks the net upshot of that is that the few get rich and most don't. A company like Apple is only employing 147,000 people, and a lot of them are on low wages. So the total number of Apple designers who are getting paid, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year is going to be very low, and the number who are going to get share options will be lower still. I've got I nearly said friend. It didn't turn out to be a friend in the end, but anyway, I know someone who was a very high paid, by most people's standards, and very high profile member of a board, a Fortune 500 company board. So they're a very senior manager in a major company, and the remuneration package was high but not stratospheric. You know, you're talking a high six-figure salary and share options when they vested, which allowed early retirement in your 40s, but a modest retirement. You've not got Ferrari money. If you play all your cards right and you get into that very high profile job, and then you take the first opportunity available to exit because the stress is going to kill you, then you're probably going to walk away with $1 million, $1.5 million, which is a bucket load of money, but it's not the major money that some people think. So these companies are diverting huge amounts into the pockets of a relatively few number of people, and even the folk who you think are really highly paid aren't as highly paid as you'd imagine. It's a bit like footballers. People have got really odd ideas about what footballers get paid. Most of Europe's footballers are not going to be immensely wealthy in retirement, despite the fact that they're exceptional footballers at the top of the game. Geophysicists, the classic oil industry worker who makes good money, the geophysicists are making, $60,000 to $100,000 when things are going okay, more during an oil boom, and they're getting laid off when the oil industry collapses. People think the wage is going to be a lot higher, but what they forget is that geophysicists have been knowledge workers since the 50s at least. Consequently, loads and loads of kids who are good at maths and physics train to be geophysicists. So companies are not going to overpay. Why would a company pay somebody $400,000 a year when they can get somebody to do it for 80? If they need somebody who's good with maths, who can dump a load of kit down a well hole and then look at the screen and work out what's going on, and they can get that for 80,000, the shareholders are not going to tolerate them paying 600,000 for it. So these companies that are dominating the knowledge economy employ relatively few highly paid workers, and the jobs that are available are in high cost parts of the world. If you want a job at one of these companies, you might end up living in Los Angeles, and that is going to be stratospherically expensive. Thousands of dollars a month, $2,000 baseline to live anywhere where you would feel safe, and therefore your after tax income, after housing cost income, and after tax income is going to be low. So you've got wage compression, very high costs, and a relatively low return on education for middle class kids. And this is essentially turning the middle classes into the kind of characters used to feature in Bruce Springsteen songs about the blue collar worker. So that's what Mark Blyth thinks is going on, and it's part of a broader analysis that guys like him engage in about the iniquities of the present situation we're in, the changes that are taking place in the global economy. Now, Blythe, it would be fair to say, is to the left of me, but that doesn't say very much because everybody's to the left of me. And as I say, he's not an economist, I don't think. He's a politics graduate, politics PhD, like me. I don't know what his undergraduate degree contained. Mine contained a little bit of economics. I did a course, a first year course on economics, and failed it. Failed it tactically because if I tried to pass it, it was going to cause me to fail other things. So then I passed it on the reset. When I was a boy at Glasgow University in the early 1980s, let me tell you, failing exams was a common thing. Glasgow University seemed to live to fail people. So I tactically failed economics and then passed it on the reset. And then I did a paper on government and economy. So I've not got a lot of economics in my quiver, but I might have more than maybe he has. I don't know. But certainly we're both politics PhDs rather than economics PhDs. And that's relevant for two reasons. One, because his analysis might not be that great. And two, it might tell us that the facts about Blythe and myself might tell us something about the problem you've got with clever working class kids generally, which I'll come back to. Now, the first thing that needs to be said is, how do unions work? And unions work by restricting supply. That's what unions are for. They're cartels, the labour market cartels. Now, as I've said many, many times, you can argue that in some places, especially in the public sector, where the managers tend to take over the provision of a public service because they don't have any competition, and they often don't have any experience in management or any particular skills. So in the public sector, having the unions involved can be less of an evil than having the managers do their own thing. The fact that a school has got a union branch of teachers would look like an attempt to coerce the owners of a business if it really was a business, but it's not. It's a public sector organisation that gets a tidal wave of money without having to account for it. And allowing the management, take for example the universities. The universities in the UK are de facto public sector institutions. They get all the money from the state. And what has happened, as the money has increased dramatically with the expansion of higher education, and no attempt has been made to control the behaviour of the small number of decision makers, is that you've got principals getting paid hundreds of thousands of pounds a year for, in my view, sod all. So Unions in some circumstances can be the lesser of two evils, but unions in their essence are labour market cartels. They try to raise the price of something by restricting the supply, and that involves ripping off at least two groups, which is the consumers of the service and the other people who would like to work in providing the service but are not allowed to because the union has restricted supply. The dock workers on the waterfront have to use violence to stop other people being dockers. That's the only way you can raise the price of being a dock worker above the natural free market level. And that kind of people like to think that the money comes out of the pocket of the investors. It usually doesn't, because as long as the situation is stable, then the investors are making their normal returns. A car company doesn't care whether the car workers form a union and prevent importation of cars so that the cars that they make can sell at high prices way above world market rates. The car company couldn't care less as long as that's what happens. They only worry if competition from abroad continues and the workers are only putting the squeeze on their supply of cars and the prices they can sell them for and the wages they have to pay the workers. But if you imagine the Ford car company in Australia and you've got labour unions in Australia that prevent the importation of Japanese cars for 30 years, Ford couldn't care less because they're still making the same returns on their investment. It's just that ordinary workers are having to pay more for their cars to pay the high wages of Ford workers in Australia. So you've got all these people who aren't car workers getting ripped off. If you're a car worker and you go and buy a meal, you expect it to be provided at the lowest possible price in a competitive environment. But the waiter who serves you has to buy a car and gets ripped off because they can't buy a Nissan car that works. They have to buy a Ford that doesn't because you've got a good union that stops the cars getting imported. So all unions are cartels. They're designed to raise prices by limiting supply. And when tenants do that, you've got to think through who actually suffers. If you're trying to sell a single family home to somebody who wants to make an apartment block in Brooklyn and you can't sell it because a tenants union prevents it, well, you're prevented from getting the high price for that home that you wanted to sell. So there's the first victim, the person that owned the property and perhaps owned it for 30 or 40 years living in a violence-riven neighbourhood in Brooklyn before the final gentrification takes place. So the old woman who wants to pocket a load of money and head off to a retirement home in Florida doesn't get the price that she should get for her single family home that she's lived in for all these years because the tenants' action group are determined to try and get the local authority, the local government, to make such sales, such development impossible. So that's your first issue. Sellers don't get their prices. And of course, what you also get is future landlords don't get the opportunity to engage in business. They don't get to be to rent out the property. And future tenants who would like to be the tenants in the new apartment block, they don't get to live there either. Now, this is what really drives me completely nuts. If we imposed a land value tax, in other words, taxing the undeveloped value of the land, that single family house in Brooklyn would have been gone 40 or 50 years earlier and the apartment block would have been built. And then that apartment block would have been gone and a better apartment block would have been built after that. And probably you would not have had all of these companies huddling in Los Angeles, London and other cities because it would have been too expensive and there would have been a constant pressure to go and move somewhere else. A land value tax, as Ricardo and Adam Smith and any number of other people, economists, have pointed out, is a perfect tax. It exactly incentivizes what you're trying to incentivize, and it reduces the perverse incentives that exist in every other system of taxation. If you tax income, you disincentivize people working. If you tax capital gains, you disincentivize arbitrage and invention and investment in future possible lucrative businesses, which might well fail but might not. So every single tax is a penalty that people are going to react to by changing their behaviour. And what a state fundamentally has as its great resource is the ability to demand rent from people for being in the state. So a land value tax would be a perfect way of solving these housing problems and solving these problems of businesses huddling in particular areas, because it would hugely incentivise moving to other areas. But for some reason, folk are not prepared to think it through, despite the fact, of course, ironically, it was an American, George, I think, surname, can't remember his first name, who was hugely prominent and sold millions of books 100 years ago explaining exactly how the system worked and why it would benefit the country. So instead what the Americans have got are nightmare systems of local taxation, really incredibly stupid systems, which have gone on for 100 years longer than the recognition of the problem. About 100 years ago, the US passed the 16th Amendment, which allowed the federal government to raise an income tax without being obliged to distribute it on the basis of any particular pattern of payment. In other words, if New York paid a lot in, that didn't change the fact that they could give it to Mississippi. So why on earth would the states, including New York, vote for such a thing? And the answer was because they knew that in a system of state and federal government, with local authorities as well, people would move out of places in order to avoid high taxation, and the rich would huddle, because rich people typically make fewer demands on the services and therefore don't want to pay for them. So what you get over time is neighbourhoods where people pay low taxation, pay essentially only for policing, precisely because they've all got good private health cover and don't need anything else. And they've got relatively low demands on local schooling because they pay independently for independent schooling. So in order to avoid the process of huddling, you have to have a national tax that people can't escape. And that's why the US 100 years ago or more, I can't remember the exact date, brought in the national income tax. Now, even with that, you still get this incredible perverse incentive in the United States. People can secede from the state and create their own local authority. So if you've got local authority, you can actually create your own little local authority within it if you can get enough signatures, and then demand a share of your state's federal funding and state income taxes and other taxes. So you've still got these perverse incentives in place, and you've still got incentives to walk away from an area where the taxes are getting out of control. In Galveston, in Texas, where I've been, I made a point of running on the beach in Galveston so that I could do a Glen Campbell tribute. Galveston is suffering a loss of population because people can't afford to pay for home insurance because the federal government won't pay for the tornado or hurricane tax. So you've got a situation in the United States where local authority taxation still doesn't make any sense, and it's having massive negative consequences in terms of changing behaviour. You've got a drift right now of people into so-called red and blue states, because it's possible in most places housing debt can be walked away from, handing in so-called jingle mail during the house. See, in the UK, if you don't owe the building society or the bank the property, people think you owe them the property or the mortgage payment. No, you don't. You owe them the cash. They've got a charge on the property, but you owe them the cash. One of my pals had some like nearly £500,000 worth of housing debt outstanding and a load of money squirreled away in investments. And I pointed out to him that the idea that he had in his head, which is heads I win, tails you lose, if I stop paying the mortgage, I'll just walk away from the mortgage and write off the deposit. That's not how it works in the UK, but it is how it works in most cases in the US. You can hand in your keys and they call it jingle mail. So you put down a small deposit and you hope the prices go up, and if they don't go up and if the local situation becomes bad and property taxes start to rise because there's a massive social problem in the area through folk needing treatment for drug addiction or for kids who've got additional needs in the schools, well, you hand in the keys and walk away from the property. So it doesn't take the brains of an archbishop to work out what can happen. If you have a situation where people get fixed rate mortgages and they can keep them if prices generally rise, in other words, mortgage rates generally rise, you can keep your fixed rate mortgage. But if rates generally fall, you can remortgage at the lower rate. Well, somebody's getting stiffed on that. And of course, as we saw with the crash in 2007-2008, it was Fannie Mae, Ginnie Mae, Freddie Mac, the other federally backed lenders, and the banks and others as well. There's no such thing as a free lunch. If you can basically do something to your advantage and the other party's disadvantage, then the other party necessarily is going to pick up the tab in some circumstances. A society as a whole can't avoid that. When it comes to this business of securitization, this again drives me nuts. I used to own corporate bonds in my pension, and it must have been 2004 I contacted Legal & General and said, you've got this corporate bond fund that I invest in, and you've got some AAA debt, you've got some AA debt, you've got some A debt, and it pays me 5.6%. I said, government gilts are 5.6%. The return on your bond fund is exactly the same as the return on absolutely 100% safe government gilts. Why on earth would I be investing in your bond fund? This doesn't make any sense. This market makes no sense. There has to be a premium for taking a risk. And of course, answer came there none. There is no answer. So I sold those corporate bonds and bought government gilts. Treasury 4¾ 2010 and Treasury 4¾ 2015 from memory. Why wouldn't everyone do that? How bloody stupid would you have to be to hold a risk asset when there is no premium to holding that risk asset? It doesn't make any sense at all. And as to the business of taking different kinds of mortgages and bundling them together. So we've got some mortgages which are thought to be very solid. The person owning the house put down a big deposit, they've got a good job, the mortgage is a small mortgage in proportion to their income, and therefore these are AAA rated mortgages. Then we've got other mortgages, and these are much more likely to fail. The person put down less money, they've got a less secure job, it's a bigger mortgage in proportion to their income. You bundle these together and they all become AAA because, oh, these are different risks. What a bloody stupid thing to say, and how stupid would any person have to be to accept that? You'd have to be as thick as two short planks. The idea that manual workers in casual employment have got very different risk profiles to upper middle class people employed in, you know, law and medicine and so on, and therefore the hit that might affect the middle class people is a different kind of hit to the one that would affect the other folk. And moreover, even if it were true that these were two uncorrelated, unconnected risks, the idea that putting those two risks together would result in the overall rating of the risk being the high rating is just too stupid for words. But this is what people said, and this is what people believed. And of course, it resulted in some folk, as I've said before, like that guy Paulson, who the book about him is called The Greatest Trade Ever. Paulson made $4 billion for himself and $20 billion for his clients by simply pointing out that reason is what reason is. And you can't avoid reason because it's inconvenient. One of the mortgage-backed securities that was being sold in huge numbers had a key characteristic taken from it. Somebody had went through the actual cost of providing these securities and recognised that there was one particular thing, I can't remember what it was, but there was one particular aspect which raised the overall price. And if you took that out, you could sell cheaper. So what this guy did was he took it out, and therefore his company became the big seller of these securities. And one particular aspect that suited the other party. Charles Clark, the former education secretary, Labour education secretary, said, "How many medieval historians does the economy actually need?" Well, I'll tell you. A good medieval historian would have read that document and noticed that the thing was missing, which everybody who hadn't read it just assumed was there. So this this critique that Blythe has got is predicated on a whole load of assumptions about how taxation operates and how we should best tax the economy. How should we best tax the people? Because all taxes are paid by people. How should we best tax people in order to meet our collective needs? And the answer is using taxes that don't distort behaviour in harmful ways. And the local authority taxation and the extraordinary returns that it delivers to people for no good reason at all, because we refuse to actually levy a land value tax, and instead we allow people who buy properties and then get lucky to capture what is effectively a collectively produced piece of value. Because it's the growth of a city like New York, which isn't the product of anybody who just happens to own a bit of the land there. That's what gives you the property value. The reason why you can pull down a single family home and build an apartment block and make a fortune, and the person selling the single family home makes a fortune, is precisely because the state isn't doing what it should do, which is to impose the proper tax on the undeveloped cost of the land. If they did that, the person selling the single family home would find they'd get a much lower price because this massive land value tax that the buyer would have in prospect when they bought it. Now, going on to the issue of college kids and not getting terribly well paid. The problem with college kids, and this is why it's interesting to think about Mark Blyth and myself, I think he's fairly working class. I certainly am incredibly working underclass or working class. And I remember in the 1980s, I think he's roughly the same age as me, maybe a bit younger. I remember the 1980s, and I remember suiting myself, and I remember my pals suiting themselves. And I remember the belief that you would be saved regardless, because there'd be a wee place for you, probably in the public sector somewhere. And I knew what I should have done, and I chose not to do it because I thought I would escape. And as it turned out, I was right, but only just. This idea that the world owes you a living, and that that folks somehow should benefit just because they've got this bit of paper. Why? Why should the middle class be entitled to do what we would deprecate if the working class did it, or certainly people like me would attack if the working class did it? This idea of the graduate job, I drifted into politics from trying other things and finding them too hard. I was smart enough to do maths and physics, but I just was a little bit lazy. My physics teacher, Brian Rookley, went to school, and my mother said that to me one day, right straight to my face. She said, "You're not stupid, are you? Completely bloody idle, but not stupid." I drifted out of things that I knew would be more highly paid and would be probably more useful for society for my own convenience and laziness and interest. I was interested in other things. If you're interested in English literature and you could study economics or engineering, then you're probably going to pay a price for that, and it's right that you do pay a price for it. This idea that the world owes everybody what have now become described as bullshit jobs, I drifted into accountancy. If it hadn't been accountancy initially, and then in the public sector, if it hadn't been accountancy, it'd have probably been insurance. Most of these kind of waster graduate jobs that were taken by people like me have become disintermediated. What's actually happened is that instead of having a job where you get to sit in an office and use what amounts to comparethemarket.com to find the cheapest insurance or the best pension offer, people can now do that themselves. I can do most of what financial brokers and advisors used to do through Morningstar's website and Hargreaves Lansdown's website. So all of these kiddie-on jobs that used to provide us a comfortable living, some poor working class guy's going to bust his ass all day in a brewery, and he gets told things about mortgages, or he has his flat purchase arranged by some solicitor, or he has his pension arranged by some financial advisor. And all of the things that they are doing are pretty rudimentary. What you've really got is a medieval guild, in exactly the same way that not Monty Python, the crew with what's his name, John Cleese and the rest of them, who did the famous spoofs, including Jabberwocky, is Python, but they called them something else, I think, for those movies. But the crew with Michael Palin being amazed at Watt Dabney would be begging in the street, having cut his foot off. Watt Dabney, the Watt Dabney, inventor of the inverted firkin. Because Watt Dabney cut his foot off and became a beggar because the medieval guilds controlled coopering, barrel making in his town. Now, that was a spoof on trade union activity, but that kind of either activity in the case of regulatory barriers like solicitors having a monopoly of conveyancing, or de facto barriers because financial institutions were able to. Pre the days of wide availability in the web, you were able to use your monopoly access to fairly unsophisticated things to make money for kids that sounded plausible and wore a suit. Because what was often being done in insurance companies was you were just employing kids, not because they had any particular skills, but because they had a certain kind of manner. If you listen to me talking right now, I sound as if I know what I'm talking about to some degree. And that was exactly why commercial union and Allied Dunbar would employ people like me to wear a navy blue suit and persuade pensioners to buy with-profits bonds, which were complete bullshit from start to finish. So all of those jobs have been disintermediated. And good, the world doesn't owe middle-class kids kiddie-on jobs. Working folk don't have to pay high prices to get inadequate services from people like me. And Mark Blyth is complaining about the loss of what effectively amounted to an opportunity for rent-seeking behaviour on the part of wasters. People who behave the way I behaved in 1983 come badly unstuck now. Good. When a company buys your labour, they're doing exactly the same thing that you do when you buy somebody else's labour. If you pay somebody to come out to your house and clean it, or to tune your car, I saw somebody outside yesterday here fixing the windscreen in a car. When you pay people to do these things, you're often doing something that you're paying them to do something you could have done yourself, but it serves your interest to pay them because they can do it quicker and more efficiently. When companies employ you, they're aiming at their own interest, just as you aim at your interest when you buy things. You're effectively a company of one, and you treat everybody else as if they're a company of one as well. You would drop your electricity supplier. You would go to a different pub, a different nightclub, use a different taxi company. You make every single decision in a way that suits you. And you don't think for one minute you're doing anything wrong, and you aren't doing anything wrong. Because the welfare state and treating other people as worthy of consideration and care, and addressing the issue of hunger that cannot help itself, as Hegel called it, I think, in the 19th century. All of that's important, but that's not what you do when you make market decisions. There's an old model of behaviour and thinking about the economy that I used to use regularly when I was talking to students. If you think about being a slave and being a king in an economy, a king can never lose their job, and a slave can lose their job very easily. So if you, for example, are employed as an employment appeals tribunal judge or a chief constable or some other state functionary, it's very unlikely you're going to lose your job. If you are running a fast food outlet and somebody down the road opens a better fast food outlet, then you're probably going to lose your job, lose your business. Now, what everybody wants is to be a king when they consume and a king when they produce. In other words, you want to be able to put people out of business with your spending decisions, but you don't want to be able to be put out of business yourself. You don't want to lose your job. So that's the preferred position. But of course, people don't like that. Other people don't like the idea they have to buy your services. So people don't like the idea that they have to buy, from British Telecom the right to phone their granny at a ridiculous price. So they insist that they be given the opportunity to buy from Smarty a SIM for £20 a month that gives them unlimited calls and unlimited data. So we demand the right to be kings when we spend. We're not very tolerant of other kings. We're not very tolerant of other people forcing their goods and services on us. Now, of course, everybody thinks like that. So the worst of all possible worlds is being a slave. When you consume, you have to buy the things that other people produce that are rubbish. And you're a slave when you are at work. In other words, you can be put out of your job very easily. That's the worst of all possible worlds. The only stable situation is being a king when you consume and being a slave when you work. And that's what modern Western liberal democracy and capitalist free enterprise economy involves. You get to put the nightclub out of business by going to a different nightclub when they've been relying on your custom for years, but the other place was better, so you went there. And everyone just accepts that. You go to a better gym because it's cheaper, and that's just the way it is. So everyone gets to be sovereign when they spend their money, and they accept that sovereignty that other people have as well. So you're a king when you spend, and you're a slave when you produce, and that's the only stable situation. And people can accept that when you ask them to consider buying fast food or nightclub access. But what they don't accept is that the employer who's going to lay you off because people's spending decisions have meant you're unemployable, or they're going to take you on because people's spending decisions have made you employable. People don't accept that as being a function of other folks' decisions. They think it's a function of the employer's arbitrary caprice. So they think that the reason why the employer's only going to pay you £10 an hour rather than 25 is because they're just ripping you off and they could pay you more and they just choose not to. But there's a basic concept in economics called ordinary profits. And ordinary profits are where you end up with. All businesses trend towards ordinary profits. So if you're Vodafone in 2000, you may be making extraordinary profits, but you'll find that other companies set up, masts are not that expensive to locate, and you'll get bid down until it's. If you look now, it's very easy to get a package on a phone that's dirt cheap, and the companies are making normal profits. So when you make your spending decisions, it's you're putting pressure on companies that result in the management making decisions and the owners making decisions, and you would like to believe that these managerial and owner decisions are simply the products of their nasty bourgeois capitalistic demands, but they're not. The companies are price takers as well. The companies are under enormous pressure. Now, what Mark Blyth does is he picks all the companies that he thinks right now have got massive pricing ability. In other words, they can actually dictate prices and they can control the competition. They can use patent law. They can use oligopoly or monopoly power. They can buy their competitors and therefore they can dictate prices. I wonder if that's the best way to think about it. If it is the best way to think about it, then there will come a point where we'll have to do to these companies what was done to Standard Oil and to the IT, it was AT&T, and they created the so-called baby bells. They broke it up. If there really is a question that these companies are becoming price setters rather than price takers, then that'll have to be addressed. But I think there's scant evidence that's actually what's going on right now. It's just that Facebook has got a first mover advantage when it comes to providing this network. Robert Nozick, the political philosopher, talks about cafes and why a cafe can become top cafe despite the fact that it's just serving the same coffee as every other. And it's because it becomes the place where you go to be seen. But that's not a particularly stable situation. And there's loads and loads of competitors because the cost. Mark Bly thinks the cost of entry is high. The most obvious thing about the modern world is the cost of entry is low. I'm sending out this podcast at effectively no cost at all. The modern world is a world of disintermediation. And what Bly thinks he sees, which is monopoly pricing power, I think that's false. What you actually see all around you is disintermediation. The people who used to have bullshit middle-class jobs are now huddling in the few places where they can continue with their behaviour, and that's in, for example, the public sector. The reason why it's possible to have somebody sitting in a college taking a paper register and then entering that on an online system is precisely because the people who run colleges are not under competitive pressure in the way that other businesses are. So the reason why it's possible to have 60,000 pound special advisors huddling around Nicola Sturgeon and other ministers in the Scottish Government is precisely because Nicola Sturgeon and the Scottish Government don't have any competitors. There isn't an alternative Scottish Government because the other political parties are a disaster area and they would behave in exactly the same ways if elected. The people of Scotland have no real control over what's being done. And that truth about politics, and of course we can look at the procurement scandals surrounding the COVID crisis. I noticed that Matt Hancock has been taken to court. But the only places where you find really, really shoddy, disgraceful rent-seeking behaviour are in the public sector. It's in the universities. It's people delivering degree courses that are completely meaningless and don't involve any of the kind of activities that would produce real skills in the students. That's where the rent-seeking continues. It's not in the commercial sector. The pressure that Apple is under from really fantastic rival providers of MP3 players, mobile phones and everything else means that I think you have to be very, very careful when you invest in a company like Apple because it's not obvious to me that they've got the kind of moats that would imply long-term excessive returns. Tesla in particular, I think, is a disaster waiting to happen. The ability of the established manufacturers to make electric cars means that you'd have to be a very, very confident, bold or ill-informed person to invest in Tesla. The preciousness of the middle classes is irritating. A.A. Gill, who died unfortunately a few years ago of cancer, A.A. Gill, the Sunday Times writer, said something really funny one day. He said, all these lovies, all these actors, all these dancers, all these performers, who complain about the pressure of their business, you know, having to go to auditions and not knowing where the next meal's coming from. A. Gill said, plumbers call these quotes. Yeah. Every plumber, every joiner who goes and does a quote is engaged in an audition. You don't hear too many people in The Guardian crying over their high pressure work environment. On the broader issue of exactly what the split is between capital and labour. The returns on capital for 150 years have been 5.1%. The companies that are making extraordinary money right now will not make extraordinary money in the future. And the idea that the worker is disempowered and what chance, what prospect have they got but to be drawn into LA or London or New York and be ripped off for high rents and so on. The opportunity for workers to simply, and Nozick said this in 1974, if you run through the numbers and look at what it actually costs to be in business, there's no reason why you shouldn't have far more workers' collectives. For the amount of money the average liberal arts graduate spends on their education, they could easily establish a workers' collective. Nozick sarcastically poses the question, if the United Auto Workers, who were constantly moaning about their remuneration in the 1970s and moaned and acted for 30 years until finally they broke the companies and they all went bust. If the United Auto Workers really thought that they were being ripped off by General Motors or Ford or Chrysler, why didn't they simply buy the plants? And if you say, oh, but they don't know how to run the plants, you know, there's a certain amount of monopoly skill that the owners have got. Why not employ your own managers? Why not employ your own entrepreneurs to pick out the best investment opportunities? Nozick sarcastically says, let's avoid thinking about what the actual wage rate for those entrepreneurs and managers would be. In other words, his suspicion is, and it's my suspicion as well, that if you actually established a workers' cooperative and employed managers and entrepreneurs to run it and to find business opportunities, what you discover is the workers get paid the same. Their wages plus their dividends would be exactly the same as they would have got by investing in any other business and just working for a business. Because the managers and the entrepreneurs and the capitalists are not taking any more out of the business than is necessary to take out of it. Because if they were, in the case of the managers, they'd be sacked and cheaper managers would be employed. The company, if it's making extraordinary profits, will find competition drives down the rate of return. This idea, this fundamental Mark Blyth view of the world, that there's opportunities for politicians to rearrange the world so as to benefit everybody. There isn't. There never has been. The story that the left tells about the priority of politics over economics has been false since the dawn of time. And the thing that really irritates people like me is that when there is a political win because of earlier stupidity, for example, a land value tax, that's the thing they ignore. Like a dog returning to its own vomit, they come back to this business about monopoly power when it doesn't exist, or underpayment of workers, or undercutting, as Jeremy Corbyn used to always call it. Undercutting. Corbyn, a man who worries about the plight of the poor all around the world and then says it's wrong for them to get jobs. The left ignores the low-hanging fruit when it comes to reforming the world to make it better. And there's a reason for that, because they like condemning people who are currently in better positions than they themselves are. Henry Kissinger said this about academic arguments. They're so bloody because the stakes are so low. You've got people who are on, in comparison to the rewards of people they consider themselves to be the equals of, the peers of, they're on low returns, they can't, nothing much can happen to them. Once they're tenured, nothing much is going to happen. So if you want to see a really petty fight, go to academia. That's where you're going to find the petulance. As to there being good returns in housing, I think Mark Blyth must have ignored the last 18 months. What we've had for 18 months is a state-sponsored non-payment of rent. So the high returns that people have got through buying housing, they've not existed for the last 18 months because people have just been defaulting on their rent, and the law has allowed them to. There's a famous saying in landlord-tenant relations: you never win in housing court. If the courts, particularly in the United States, because you've got elected judges in a lot of places, and the tenants are many and the landlords few. So if you go to housing court, then you're probably going to lose. The situation in the UK when it comes to property, again, is just not only depressing, but just maddening. We're in a situation in the UK where we've forgotten our history to such an extent, it's hard to know how it could have happened. People don't remember that we used to rent from insurance companies. It used to be Guardian Royal Exchange and the Prudential who owned hundreds of thousands of houses and rented them out to ordinary folk. It wasn't the local authorities, it was insurance companies. And because we didn't like the idea of profit, a profit is nothing more than you've arranged a whole load of factors of production and it was worth doing. That's what tells you should continue, because if it's something left over, you haven't made a loss. You've managed to earn your money back. The investment wasn't a, you didn't give up some of your present consumption for a stupid reason. But and that holds true for whether you're building public bridges and council housing, or whether you're actually buying property and trying to rent it out. And we forget that the reason why we don't have the kind of housing rental stock that we need is precisely because we made decisions to force the insurance companies to sell up, because we weren't prepared to think for two bloody seconds about the situation that they were in and the cost of being in business. And exactly why they weren't actually overcharging their tenants, because it's an expensive business trying to run property. Suppose a company was making extraordinary profits, and instead of letting them make extraordinary profits for the normal period of time before competition kicked in and they made less, the workers in that company were allowed to use the threat of violence to prevent the company sacking them and employing workers. Because when the worker gets employed, they're happy to receive that wage rate. Nozick again uses the example of the Ford workers making the Edsel car that was a complete disaster. They got paid just the same despite the fact the car didn't sell. Now, if the car had sold really well, the workers in that plant might have thought, oh, the company's made a lot of money out of the Edsel, maybe we should get paid more money. Now, of course, the company workers were happy to take the pay rate before the Edsel car sold or didn't sell. So the company wins big if the Edsel is a success, but the workers don't lose big if the Edsel doesn't sell. The worst that happens to them is they lose their jobs. But they've not, it's not as if they've invested. They're workers, they get paid their wages regardless of whether at the end of the day the rock concert's a complete disaster. If you're a worker and the concert doesn't come off, the boxing promotion doesn't come off. You know, if you're a doctor and you agree to turn up to be the doctor at a boxing promotion and the tickets don't sell, the promoter still has to pay you, they've got a legal obligation. So the heads I win, tails you lose attitude to an employer is a silly attitude if you think it through. Because suppose for the sake of argument, a company was making extraordinary profits like Apple, you'd think, maybe Apple's making extraordinary profits right now. What would happen if you allowed the workers for Apple to demand higher wages and the company couldn't sack those workers and employ willing workers at the wages which were initially accepted by the workers it did employ? What would happen then? What would happen then is you would have fewer companies actually setting up and trying things, because you'd have changed the decision matrix for the people investing. They would look at it and they would think, well, you're telling me that there's a 1 in 10 chance we're going to go bust, and there's a 2 in 10 chance this is going to be a tremendous success. But I reckon it through, and if we go bust and lose everything, and if it is a success, then the workers are going to take all the money anyway, so this isn't worth investing in. So one of the things that happens if workers claim the rights of investors is that investors walk away. And it doesn't take 2 seconds thought to think that through. Right now, Dambisa Moyo wrote a book, How the West Was Lost, and she points out that the thing that stands behind most massive disasters is the bondholders not holding the equity holders to account. A company has got bondholders and equity holders usually. The equity holders get everything that's left over when the company's paid its bills. The bondholders only get their interest. So the bondholders have got an interest in making the company run modestly and safely so that they get their interest, thereby squeezing the returns available to the shareholders. Now, if the bondholders go to sleep, the company goes bust. The worst that happens to the equity holders is that they lose their investment, but most of the company's actual capital is bondholder capital, and the bondholders could never have benefited from the company doing really well, but they can benefit from it doing badly. In exactly the same way, if you reason through why most people invest in standard companies and don't invest in venture capital, taking big chances, it's because if you invest in a whole range of venture capital projects, you'll average out and get roughly the same as you would have got otherwise. There is no such thing as a free lunch. The idea that you can just take a chance and it's going to pay off, you take a chance and you'll lose when you'll introduce more volatility into it. And if you introduce volatility into lots and lots of different investments and average out what you get, you'll be getting roughly the same as you would get if you just invested in a FTSE 100 tracker at the start. Most hedge funds, which people think are a tremendous thing, all these rich people investing in hedge funds, most hedge funds underperform the broader market. There is no free lunch available. And if you try to take away one of the upside lunches of companies that do well, like Apple, all that happens is you'll have less venture capital and fewer attempts to make it big. Because if you can't make it big to compensate for the ones that go wrong, the whole category of things that will either go big or go wrong will be shrunk dramatically. Why the hell would anybody take a chance on a business if it's a greater risk of it going wrong than other comparable businesses? And if it goes right, you don't get any more, because the workers walk out the door with higher wages, having formed a picket line outside threatening violence to anybody who dares to come in and take their jobs. Stop and think it through. There's a slightly sarky remark that's sometimes made in the States. Republicans have Android phones, Democrats have Apple. Right. Here's something that nobody really wants to think about when it comes to the extraordinary profits that are made by some companies. When you can sell a fleece for £300 and people will buy it. You can sell a pair of trainers for £150. You can sell disposable razors for £20 a packet because they've got the right kind of advertising behind them. Warren Buffett, one of the world's richest men, has invested in companies that have got a certain kind of intellectual property. Intellectual property can be registered design or patent or copyright or something similar. And essentially what Buffett does is he invests in companies that have got registered designs like Gillette or Coca-Cola, or copyright in terms of names, rather than things that have got patents. And there's a reason for that, because patents go out of date, but registered design copyright doesn't. And why on earth would any sane person invest in things that have just got a name like Coca-Cola? It's not that difficult to make cola. You know, anyone can make cola. So why the hell would somebody like Warren Buffett invest in companies like that? And the answer is, Buffett understands the kind of people who buy Apple phones. And you know what? If he has got a phone, I'll bet it's Android. Peace.